This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Money, politics, and the Internal Revenue Service. What do you suppose could possibly go wrong there? Also on the broadcast today, an update from Bangladesh and a special investigation beyond payday loans, we're calling it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 13th of May. Good as always to have you with us. And we begin today with a quick flip through the Internal Revenue Code, Section 501C4, to be precise. The subheading reads, Civic Leagues, Social Welfare Organizations, and Local Associations of Employees. You would be well within your rights to ask why we're starting with the tax code, to which I would answer, because the President of the United States was talking about it today. At a press conference at the White House this afternoon, President Obama said that the IRS singling out conservative groups when they applied for tax-exempt status under that section, 501c4 again, was, quote, outrageous. 501c4 applications have more than doubled the past 3 years because politically motivated groups on the right and the left have discovered how helpful they can be in raising money. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains the difference between the spirit and the letter of the American tax code.
The traditional 501c4s are organizations like the NAACP and the American Civil Liberties Union.
Technically, they exist to do issue advocacy and issue lobbying.
Jeremy Kulish with the Urban Institute says they can be political, but that's not supposed to be their primary purpose.
Who decides how to define primary purpose? The IRS. But they've never laid out their criteria for making their decisions.
Sheila Krumholtz is the executive director at the Center for Responsive Politics. She says part of the fuzziness stems from the fact political campaign funding by 501c4s is relatively new.
This is a sea change brought about by Citizens United.
That was a 2010 Supreme Court decision. It removed limits on political donations and allowed 501c4 groups to run ads about federal candidates. Krumholtz says for last year's election, 501c4s spent $250 million, mostly on political ads, like this one from the pro-Obama group Priorities USA.
So far, the Republicans support taxing the middle class instead of the wealthy.
Jeremy Kulish says avoiding taxes isn't the only perk of the 501c4 status. Those groups also don't have to reveal who's funding them.
Organizations can choose this tax status, pick a very generic sort of name like Americans for Freedom, and basically operate in the shadows.
Last year, 2,800 organizations applied for 501c4 status. Only 8 were rejected. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
If you want to learn more about how 501c4s work in real life, check out the collaboration we did with Frontline last year. Big Sky, Big Money is what we called it. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Major retailers have 2 days left to sign onto a legally binding agreement to improve factory conditions in Bangladesh. And whatever American companies decide to do about that, the government of Bangladesh has some big decisions to make itself. Today, the cabinet made it easier for garment workers to join trade unions, which is no small thing in a country where textiles account for 80% of its exports. The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar is in Dhaka. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Does this news today about the government perhaps making it easier to unionize in these factories, does that lead you to believe that maybe the government there gets it, that they understand what's at stake?
I think the problem is they're really caught between two stools.
Then that's rock and a hard place, right?
That is a rock and a hard place. This is such an important element of the Bangladesh economy. It's one of the largest producers of cheap clothes in the world, just behind China. But the bottom line is they're very nervous that another country is going to pick up the business that's been theirs for a while. So I think they're trying to do two things at once. They're trying to show everyone that they care and they're going to bring in steps that are needed. But at the same time, they're going to do everything they can to protect the industry.
So when you get out and about, do you think, and you talk to regular people, do you think Bangladeshis believe anything's going to change as a result of this collapse?
The overwhelming sentiment on the streets here is that not much is going to change. And there's also an overwhelming feeling that the two are two are very closely linked. That is, the government or politicians, if you like, have interests in the garment industry. They own businesses or they own buildings. And therefore, it's very difficult for them to do anything about it. So there's a lot of skepticism, which is probably why a section of Bangladeshis, the workers, have started to become a little more vocal, even a bit more violent in their protests.
Well, if Bangladeshis could speak directly to an American audience, what do you think they would say? What do you think they want American businesses and American consumers to know about all this?
Well, there's a section of the Bangladeshi people who definitely think that for too long people on the high streets of the world, if you like, of America, have just got away by buying extremely cheap products, clothes. But for many others, the people they have in their sights at the moment are the factory owners. They think these are people who have built unsafe premises, unsafe buildings and factories. So at the moment, for most Bangladeshis, those are the bad guys.
As you've been there reporting out this story for the past number of days, what's the thing that hit you right away? What's the thing that struck you most when you got there?
Well, I think the first thing that strikes you is just how helpless a lot of people are, which is quite tragic, given how many people around the world are sort of linked to this entire industry. I was walking through the rubble yesterday, and I came across an order booklet, which had obviously been left behind, complete with designs of shirts, instructions on how they're to be made. And it was actually really overwhelming to see that and think that this is a book that contains a list of orders for a country somewhere out there in the world. And somebody who's going to buy that shirt off the shelf probably doesn't know who's made it and what they had to endure to do it.
Sanjoy Majumdar in Dhaka, Bangladesh, for the BBC. Sanjoy, thank you.
Thank you.
Wall Street today was kind of underwhelming. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can find payday lenders and stories about payday lenders in almost every city in this country. Those are, as you know, high interest loans. They're due in full on the borrower's next payday. Today, though, we're going to do a different slice of the subprime consumer loan market. Installment loans due in monthly installments, typically 6 months to a couple of years, usually marketed to the same low-income credit-challenged consumers that payday lenders go after. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the first installment of a collaboration with ProPublica, Beyond Payday Loans.
I was sure the GPS was steering me wrong in my search for installment loans gone bad as I approached the home of Katrina Sutton in suburban Atlanta. Down a wooded lane to a red brick Tudor.
Nice to meet you.
You're Katrina.
I am. I got the basement apartment.
Sutton lives here with her grandfather.
I think it's just antique stuff that he picked up along the way. They was really into antiques.
Her grandfather's making the house payments on his disability check.
My grandfather, now he's a little shy of struggling.
And Katrina Sutton, at 31 years old, with a GED, no assets, and more than $15,000 in student debt, she's just plain struggling. She had a job delivering auto parts.
I got laid off, and then I started working for Walmart. It was part-time, so I was trying to get bills taken care of.
Then a crisis.
I went into a car issue.
She drives a 97 Crown Victoria. It was her grandmother's.
It had something to do with the brakes, so I just knew I had to have it done because I couldn't be driving it. So I got the loan.
The loan. A high-interest installment loan. She got it from World Finance, one of the nation's biggest installment lenders. So here's how it works. You borrow a few hundred to a few thousand dollars. Now, unlike a payday loan, which is due all at once when you get your paycheck, you pay this loan off over time in fixed monthly installments. Since the borrowers tend to be pretty high credit risk, the interest is pretty high too. World loads on fees and several kinds of credit insurance. Nothing illegal here, but like payday loans, they can lead borrowers into a deepening cycle of debt. So back to Katrina Sutton's case. She borrowed around $200. That was enough to fix the brakes on her Crown Victoria. Then Walmart cut her hours, and she got sick.
They told me if I had to miss a payment, I had to come back in and refinance it.
Refinance means renew. World started the loan all over again.
I was getting more behind. I was trying to figure out why.
The why is actually pretty easy once you understand how these loans work. First of all, there's the high cost of borrowing the money. On her $200 loan, Sutton had to pay back an extra $150 or so in interest, fees, and insurance. The annual percentage rate listed on Sutton's loan contract, that's the APR, was 90%, already pretty high. But if you add in the cost of credit insurance, the loan has an effective APR of 182%, according to an analysis by ProPublica. The other reason Sutton got more behind, renewing the loan, enticed by a payout. She got a small check for some of the principal she'd already paid off.
Once you renew it, it's like you get a little bit. One time, I think they gave me like $40 off of it and then added that more interest into it and then all these other fees that they didn't tell me about.
3 out of 4 world loans are renewed before they're paid off. Chris Kukla at the Center for Responsible Lending says this can be very expensive for borrowers.
Every time they go in and refinance, they pay a new origination fee. They pay more credit insurance fees if they take the credit insurance. It is not uncommon for someone to walk in and years later end up paying 3 times what they borrowed.
Sometimes borrowers just stop paying and it can get
real ugly, came out to my job, came out to my home.
That's after Sutton defaulted.
I was going to look into the claims.
The Office of Bankruptcy Attorney Barbara Braziel in Savannah.
Then you've got a disability insurance premium of $30, something called a maintenance fee of...
The bankruptcy client Braziel is seeing today makes $34,000 a year as a computer technician. She borrowed about $2,500 from World Finance and one of its subsidiaries.
The character of her debt was medical bills, student loans, and these two finance companies. And that really drove the train.
The client's loans were at 42% and 109% effective APR. When she fell behind, World sued and garnished her wages. Attorney Braziel says her clients don't have a lot of sources for borrowing money aside from the high-cost storefront lenders like World in their communities.
And I, too, was a single mom. You're trying to keep the lights on. You're trying not to be homeless. So you really just need to solve the problem you have in front of you. And the cost is secondary. Sometimes those people are the only people there for you.
World declined to speak with Marketplace and ProPublica. In response to submitted questions, World said that its customers demonstrate by their repeat business that they value the company's service and products. The company said it only issues repeat loans when borrowers want them, that its collection methods are proper and legal, and that all interest, fees, and insurance premiums are disclosed to borrowers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell's back tomorrow with part two of our collaboration with ProPublica, the business end of installment lending tomorrow, and also when regulators might start paying attention to it. There is more on our website, Mitchell's Reporter's Notebook, and a slideshow as well. Marketplace.org is where you need to go. Coming up, those credit card offers you get, it's not about you, it's about them.
These are also the type of customers that the financial services companies want in the fold for their other products and services.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 26 points today, 0.1%, finished at 15,091. The NASDAQ edged up 2 points, nearly 0.1%, ended at 3438. The S&P 500 was pretty much flat. came to rest at 16.33. J.P. Morgan Chase rose 1.5%. Today, Citigroup and Goldman Sachs each added about 0.3%. Morgan Stanley, though, retreated 1%. Bank of America off 0.3%. Healthcare was a strong sector today. Pfizer led the way up 2.25%. In the markets, Yum Brands fell 2%. The parent company of KFC and Taco Bell saw a big slump in Chinese sales driven by bird flu worries. AutoZone raced down 1.25% after Deutsche Bank cut its stock from buy to hold. You gotta hate when that happens. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the third annual Global Diaspora Forum continues. This year's theme, where ideas meet action. 40 years ago, Skylab was out of this world. The nation's first space station and laboratory was launched into Earth orbit. And he's ranked number 66 on Forbes' list of the world's billionaires. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg turns 29. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Consider, if you would, the humble soybean. You can eat it directly. You might put soy milk in your coffee, or more likely eat meat that's fed on crushed pieces of soy. I mention that because the by far dominant maker of soybean seeds, Monsanto, won a big case today at the Supreme Court. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now on Goliath beating David.
Like Intel's dominance in the chip market, almost every soybean in America has Monsanto inside. Monsanto makes some 90% of soybean seeds sold. And the product patent means farmers have to buy them every year. Today's case threatened to undo that. But Mark Patterson at Fordham Law School says the ruling means the company gets to keep its hefty market share.
It gives it the freedom to continue to control year by year the sales of its products to farmers.
Once a chemical company, Monsanto came to dominate the seed business over the past two decades. Economist Neil Harrell at Iowa State says first, the company patented its Roundup herbicide and Roundup Ready seeds. Then, it acquired other seed companies. And as he sees it, it now impedes competition.
Beating in the heart of every good capitalist is the heart of the monopolist. And so we have to have rules, we have to have the economic police on the beat, or we end up with concentration, and that means higher prices.
By one estimate, farmers pay double for the Monsanto product, though some say it pays for itself in higher yields. Now, patent protections expire, and Monsanto's Roundup Ready product effectively goes generic next year. But Indiana soy farmer Ron Moore says that's the original, obsolete version.
You're not going to buy a Commodore 64 in today's computer market. They just aren't going to make it because no one will buy it. And so that's what's going to happen to the varieties that have Roundup Ready 1 herbicide tolerant traits in them.
Now, Roundup Ready 2.0 seeds are on the market. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The annual television extravaganza known as the Upfronts started today in New York. Networks throwing big parties to introduce their fall schedules, and they hope, in the process, convincing advertisers to part with billions of dollars in ad spending. But the upfronts come at a time when the television business is changing, and maybe not in a good way for those networks. Warren Littlefield knows from television. He used to be president of NBC Entertainment. Mr. Littlefield, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What do you think of the upfronts? Is that a good way for them to do business, the networks?
They've adjusted themselves a bit. For network and cable, there's approximately $20 billion up for grabs. Mm. So you better show some showmanship.
I get that. But they throw these big parties. They roll out the pilots and the stars and all this stuff. And then 6 months on, you know, 87% of these pilots wind up getting canceled. What kind of way is that to do business?
Well, a lot of young is led to slaughter. There's no question about that. Really, their pitch this week in New York will be, advertisers, if you want to sell, then you must come to us.
I wonder whether audiences don't care much about anymore about where their show is, whether it's network or cable or Hulu or Aereo, to mention a dirty word in the name of broadcast. Yeah, I know, right? And we'll get there in a minute. But I mean, they just want the content, right? And just give it to me, man.
I think that's true. But I think more and more it becomes a strategy of really who are they as a network. And a consistent view of who you are tends to pay off.
Do you think so, really? Because my guess would be that viewers don't care who the heck the networks are. They just want the shows, man. I want my Good Wife, and I want my Mad Men, and I want it when I want it, where I want it, and I don't care who you think you are.
Well, my DVR knows me quite well. Yeah. But I think if you look at a network like CBS, they're not the youngest, they're not the hippest, but that consistency of vision is what they're going to tout when they go out there this week.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because your old network, NBC, had its upfront today, and the network name I was reading most in the NBC upfront write-ups was CBS.
Yes, well, NBC, certainly, they have a lot to prove, but right in the middle of the year, when they say goodbye to the NFL, then they've got a big boost with the Olympics, and hopefully they'll be able to take advantage of that.
He says, fingers crossed, right?
Exactly.
All right. Just quickly on this Aereo thing, this new startup company that will record things over the air and then play it back for you whenever basically you want it. How slow do you think network television has been in adapting to the new technology and new business models?
I think networks have been like the music industry, where they feared change. They do have reach. They still have muscle. They're not dead yet. However,
that is not a resounding endorsement.
Well, look, while they still have that circulation, you know, 10 million viewers for an average show up against a cable model, that's still a very good number. That's a very good reach. So they have to take that and say, how else are we going to bond with the audience? How are we going to offer our vision will become the favorite show, in the same way that I suspect you and I reach out for some of our cable hits.
How do you get your television? Are you a DVR guy? Are you a Hulu guy? Are you a Netflix guy?
Live sports, I watch the way it was intended, live. Otherwise, I'm going to my DVR, and that DVR is screaming at me every night saying, Warren, it's time. Take a look.
Warren Littlefield used to be the president of NBC Entertainment. He's now producing Fargo for FX. Mr. Littlefield, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
My pleasure.
From the Federal Reserve last week came this economic tidbit. The rate of consumer borrowing has slowed down. Americans are, it seems, still just a little bit wary of piling on too much debt. And banks and credit card companies are equally nervous about handing out loans to just anybody, you know. Still, there are people out there who get credit card offers in the mail all the time with more perks and rewards than you know what to do with. There is, of course, a reason that happens. Sally Herships has it.
May I just ask, what is the deal? For a while, every time I went to the ATM, opened my snail mail, or watched TV, I saw offers from my bank trying to give me money. I'm talking about 5% cash back when I use my credit card, but know that I already get 1% back on all my purchases. Should I be skeptical? Why does my bank keep offering me more money?
They want as much of your business as they can get.
Greg McBride is a senior analyst with Bankrate.com. He says even though the economy is recovering, banks are not in the mood to take on risky loans. And he says the credit card industry is intensely competitive. It's dominated by only 9 companies.
So oftentimes bringing in new customers means bringing somebody in at the expense of your competitor.
Which is why, if your credit rating is good, you may be getting so many offers right now. Banks think your credit rating is hot.
These are also the type of customers that the financial services companies want in the fold for their other products and services.
Like savings accounts or a mortgage. Chris Murray works with New Control, an ad agency that specializes in financial marketing. He says consumers with good credit...
You know, the reality is... people like that already have a credit card.
So Murray says for a company like Visa or Capital One to steal customers from each other is pretty tough to pull off.
They make it very difficult for you to switch mentally to say, I'm going to walk away from the 500,000 miles I've got on American and all of a sudden start using a cashback card.
Murray says it can cost up to $500 to win a new customer, and banks measure marketing success in tenths of a percentage. For consumers, it's like the prospect of dating again when you already have a trusted special someone in your life. Who wants to reread all that small print?
Yeah, where there's bait, there's a hook.
Linwood Hines works for an engineering company in South Carolina, and his credit rating is just under 800. In the last month and a half, Hines says he's gotten 13 credit card offers in the mail.
They're from, let's see, Capital One, American Express, Citibank, Chase, United Airlines.
Hines says the offers are typical, but he's not interested in changing cards ever since he sent in a late payment on his American Express bill.
They upped my APR to 30%.
Whoa.
And that was in force forever. I had to cancel the card to get rid of it.
But what about these new cashback, free miles, 0% offers that have been showing up?
They're not going to get me. There's nothing they could offer me that, frankly, that they could afford that's going to get me to switch. And I don't think of it as cynical. I think of it as realistic.
That attitude is exactly what will keep the offers coming in. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which a little piece of the future sadly slips away. How many times have you wished that you had a flying car? Lots of times, right? Problem is that if you have a flying car, you got to know how to fly. So from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, this item, a U.S.-made flying car, more of a dune buggy, really, with a propeller and a parasail attached, but it flew anyway. It hit a tree and it crashed last week. Nobody was hurt, but the Maverick from the Florida-based company iTech was wrecked, $94,000 down the tubes. Still, though, flying car, how cool would that be, right? Okay, we got to go. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 26 points, about a 10%. The NASDAQ edged up 2 points, nearly a 10%. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Our producers include Lana Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.